Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. According to the CDC, cerebral palsy is the most common motor disability in childhood, with an estimated incidence of 1.5 to 4 per 1,000 live births. While the disease itself may present unique pharmacologic considerations, those challenges are often multiplied when a cerebral palsy patient is admitted to an acute care unit. Today, Dr. Hannah Sauer, a former pharmacy resident at Mayo Clinic Children's Center, will outline general pharmacologic principles and medication dosing considerations to safely optimize therapy in this unique patient population.
Thank you, Garrett, for the introduction, and thank you all for being here, either physically or virtually. So cerebral palsy is one of those disease states that has very strong pediatric connotations for a lot of different reasons. And so as pediatric pharmacists, we often are on a receiving end of a phone call from clinicians who typically care for adult patients about how to approach optimally managing these patients. So with this in mind, I set out to establish very firm guidelines for approaching these patients in a critically ill ICU setting. And I found, probably not much to anyone's surprise, that there's not exactly a robust body of literature to support the safest and optimal way to care for these patients. So my goal today is to set more of a broad framework from which to approach these patients in an ICU setting outside of managing their chronic disease states. So we'll do that first by walking through some of the background on the disease state of cerebral palsy in general. Then we'll dive into some broad and specific medication considerations. And we'll wrap up by honing in on some approaches to pain and sedation concerns in patients with cerebral palsy. So let's start by diving into the disease state. The very best first thing that we can do is to make an effort to differentiate kind of what cerebral palsy is and specifically maybe what it is not. You might notice throughout my presentation I have little myth busters kind of inserted in order to kind of alleviate maybe some of the intimidation that might come along with caring for some of these patients. So cerebral palsy occurs in about 200 per 1,000 live births in the United States. So what that means for you and I is that, generally speaking, caring for these patients will probably be unavoidable. We're likely to see them in a hospital setting, and the fact is that many of us in this room are probably either directly or peripherally know someone affected by cerebral palsy. Physiologically, cerebral palsy is a permanent disorder of the development of movement and posture that is associated with this kind of hallmark feature of limitations on physical activity. Pathophysiologically, the diagnostic criteria for cerebral palsy is that it has to be caused by some sort of non-progressive disturbance that occurred in the brain either during fetal development or early on in infancy. A lot of people are surprised to hear that most patients with cerebral palsy will have a pretty typical life expectancy when compared to patients without. The exception is about 5 to 10% of patients who are at risk of mortality during childhood and adolescence, primarily due to their comorbid conditions that come along with it. Deterioration of physical function can occur throughout lifetime. So I mentioned that the brain insult itself is not progressive. That's not to say that the disease state is not progressive throughout life. We know that medical interventions generally won't stop this from being a progressive disease, but we know that inappropriate interventions and lack of intervention can kind of speed up the progression of cerebral palsy. So we can first classify these patients by the severity of their disease using gross motor function scale ratings ranging from 1 to 5, with 1 being patients who are able to independently ambulate and 5 being patients who are entirely dependent for all mobility. Another surprising thing that people learn about cerebral palsy is that the fact is that most of these patients will walk, whether that's independently or with some sort of supports or walking aids. We also classify these patients by the subtype of cerebral palsy, which is more important for surgical interventions and medication management in the long term. Most commonly, about 80% of patients will present with spastic disease. That's associated with muscle rigidity and hyperreflexia. That's also broken down further into diplegic, so most commonly we see patients with primarily the legs affected and having that muscle rigidity, but we can see hemiplegia as well. The next most common kind is dyskinetic cerebral palsy, which we see in maybe 15% of patients. That's associated with abnormal and unpredictable movements of posture. And then finally, 5% or maybe less than 5% are associated with ataxic disease, which is characterized by abnormal gait and imbalance. But most typically when we're dealing with these patients, we're going to see this spastic presentation. These are also typically associated with a specific type of brain injury that occurred during fetal development. Spastic tends to be associated with hydrocephaly during fetal development. Now, it's not necessarily those limitations on functionality or mobility that make these patients so complicated to manage in an inpatient setting. It's more likely there are many comorbidities that they're likely to have that make them more challenging. Specifically, almost all of these patients will have some sort of neurologic or psychiatric comorbidity, most commonly intellectual disability, very heterogeneous, ranging from mild to very severe. And many of these patients also have epilepsy, which is something that we'll frequently see, at least in the PICU setting. Other things to think about include the development of chronic lung disease, which is typically secondary to these patients being at high risk for respiratory distress during their neonatal period. That carries risks throughout the lifetime. When combined with gastroesophageal reflux, which is seen in a majority of patients, this puts them at high risk for pulmonary complications, whether that be infections or other things related to surgeries or other interventions. It's kind of an oxymoron to think of these patients as being critically ill, because some of these patients are basically chronically critically ill. So I thought today we could focus on maybe some of the more common reasons we might see them in an ICU setting. Specifically, what we get calls about most often are those patients who are undergoing orthopedic surgery and have cerebral palsy and how to manage them during that time period. We often also see them for acute infections, most commonly in pneumonia, as I mentioned, with them being at high risk for pulmonary complications. And then in the pediatric setting, we see a lot of refractory epilepsy, which is associated with early mortality in this patient population. To make things, kind of piece things together and think about why exactly these patients are a little bit intimidating to manage, we know that adult providers and pediatric providers alike in critical care settings report low rates of confidence in their ability to effectively manage these patients or even know how to manage these patients. It's complicated a little bit by considering the patient population we're dealing with being associated with sensory deficits, verbal deficits, and intellectual disability. And there's a good body of literature to support that these patients and their families also carry significant emotional burden with their diseases. And that actually plays directly into a provider apprehension in making interventions in an acute setting. There are several disease factors that make this particularly challenging. As I've mentioned, the disease has a lot of pediatric features that carry into adulthood that make it kind of difficult to balance the right ways to approach medications and other medical interventions. And to make matters more challenging, there's sort of a limited body of literature to support a lot of the things that we do in these settings. And then finally, looking more specifically at medication factors, let's go ahead and dive right into maybe some general considerations as well as some very specific medication considerations in patients with cerebral palsy. So it's not surprising with so many comorbidities that these patients tend to be on a lot of medications. I'll point out specifically many patients are on antiepileptics, which we know carry a lot of drug interactions, and a lot of anticholinergic medications as well to keep in the back of your mind. Suffice it to say, we won't go into detail about chronic disease state management, but it's absolutely critical to assess for drug interactions and the continuation of home medications in this patient population. We know that patients with both intellectual and physical neurological disabilities do tend to be associated with increased drug sensitivity. So whether that means being more sensitive to dose increases, being those patients who are more likely to have idiosyncratic reactions, or patients who are associated with increased risk for withdrawal, we all tend to apply these concepts to patients with cerebral palsy. The fact is that unless these patients have comorbid intellectual disability, there haven't been a whole lot of cases to support that these patients are at a great increased risk for drug sensitivity, but it's probably best to use tapers and be very cautious in this patient population anyway. It's because there are a few case reports, specifically with sensitivity to sedative medications. There are some very specific drug considerations to keep in mind if you're presented with a patient with cerebral palsy in an ICU setting. There's been increased use of intrathecal baclofen for patients to control muscle spasticity, and the results have been pretty great. It's a pretty effective medication for controlling those symptoms. The problem is that in this patient population, there have been very high rates of morbidity and mortality associated with withdrawal from the intrathecal baclofen pump, occurring even within 12 to 24 hours of stopping the medication. The best approach for these patients in an ICU setting is to continue the pump if you can. If not, although it's not always reasonable, to try to plan ahead and start oral baclofen in an effort to kind of bridge that wean. Noting that oral baclofen does have about a 3 to 5 day onset and a 5 to 10 day peak, so still monitoring for withdrawal in any patient who you have to stop an intrathecal baclofen pump will be absolutely critical. So you monitor for things like tachycardia, labile blood pressures, and hypothermia, as well as neurologic symptoms like delirium and hallucinations, seizures, particularly in patients who have comorbid epilepsy, and then symptoms of stopping the medication itself, like muscle rigidity and returning of spasticity. I won't provide a specific protocol for treating baclofen withdrawal, but generally we use benzodiazepines, propofol. In some cases, we can use dantrolene to help with some of the muscle symptoms. But the best thing we can do is get an intrathecal pump restarted, noting that those oral medications probably won't be enough to bridge these patients' symptoms. Another specific drug that you may or may not have heard about being of concern in the cerebral palsy population are paralytic agents. So about 30% of patients with cerebral palsy are noted to have an upregulation of acetylcholine receptors. And so historically, it's been thought that there's a theoretical increased risk with the use of paralytic agents. Specifically, that patients receiving succinylcholine might have an increased risk of hyperkalemia, and that they might be more sensitive to non-depolarizing agents as well. Clinically, those things haven't seemed to carry too much weight. And the fact is that succinylcholine, while traditionally was avoided, more and more reports of safe use have come to light. And in fact, two studies have revealed that when compared directly to patients without cerebral palsy, there's no increased risk of hyperkalemia or malignant hyperthermia associated with succinylcholine use. The other thing is that non-depolarizing agents have shown kind of the opposite effect of what we might expect for someone with increased acetylcholine receptors. Specifically, it's thought because these patients are so small and tend to be dehydrated, and these non-depolarizing agents are very highly water-soluble, so it's thought that that kind of offsets what we might have expected to increase sensitivity. So the fact is that succinylcholine and non-depolarizing agents both might be safe to use in this patient population. And then when we think about more big picture considerations, noting that these cerebral palsy patients both in adolescence and adulthood and throughout their lives tend to have very pediatric features. This is due primarily to their body size. So they've been referred to as giant neonates because of their body surface area being so high relative to their body weight, which carries significant considerations when we think about dosing in these patients. So typically, it would be appropriate to use weight-based dosing in anyone who's under 40 kilos, and then probably to avoid the use of body surface area in these patients, knowing that it's probably not an accurate representation for basing dosing off of. These patients also tend to have poor nutritional status and a lot of gastrointestinal comorbidities, which can alter drug absorption, and then they tend to be dehydrated, as I mentioned, and hypovolemic, particularly in critical care settings, which carries pretty significant concerns for electrolyte disturbances and things along those lines. Their low muscle mass and low body fat carry kind of connotations for considering volume and distribution of medications, as well as the question of whether or not serum creatinine can really be a good marker of renal function. So this might be a patient population in which you might use cystatin C as a marker of renal function as opposed to serum creatinine. So with all of those considerations in mind, we've arrived at our first polling question. So pull out your cell phone and use your app if you have it. Otherwise, you can go to pollev.com/MayoRx, or you can text MayoRx to 22333 to join. And the question is, which of the following represents a true statement about critically ill adult patients with cerebral palsy? Is it A, serum creatinine is a reliable indicator of renal function? B, succinylcholine is an appropriate paralytic agent for rapid sequence intubation? C, intrathecal baclofen can be safely held for 48 hours? Or D, pediatric weight-based dosing should be avoided in anyone over 18 years? All right, looks like we have some results in, and I would agree that B is probably the most appropriate answer here. A, as we mentioned, serum creatinine, given the low muscle mass, is probably not a good indicator of renal function. C, intrathecal baclofen should probably not be held in patients, and we can see withdrawal within 12 hours, actually. And D, pediatric weight-based dosing does not necessarily stop at 18 years. So to review kind of some general principles for approaching medication management in a broad sense, we can use weight-based dosing even in adult patients if they're less than 40 kilos. We want to always keep medication withdrawal and idiosyncratic medication reactions on the differential when thinking about maybe an atypical presentation of symptoms. And then generally, we want to restart home medications as soon as possible in these patients. And for my last trick, I will attempt to kind of weed through some of the literature related to pain and sedation in patients with cerebral palsy in an effort to kind of identify some of the best ways we can approach these issues. So before we jump into that topic, I thought we would do a general poll. So go ahead and respond, true or false, individuals with cerebral palsy are desensitized to pain and therefore have increased pain tolerance. Okay, let's do a show of hands. So individuals with cerebral palsy are desensitized to pain and therefore have increased pain tolerance. Of those in the room, who would say true? And of those in the room, who would say false? Okay, so I'm seeing lots of hands for false and no hands for true for anyone who's tuning in and was on the edge of their seat. So I would agree. For some reason, historically, there's been this thought that patients with severe neurologic impairment and cerebral palsy specifically, for some reason, might have increased pain tolerance, and that's entirely false. In fact, these patients have increased sensitivity to pain stimuli because they have altered excitability in their somatosensory cortex. While there's kind of a lack of literature guiding us in what to do clinically and choosing medications and dosing medications, I would say there's a robust body of literature on the pain experience for patients in cerebral palsy. We won't go into the details, but know that there's significant emotional burden for these patients and spiritual burden as well. If you're interested, there's a lot of things out there to read about. These patients have a very heterogeneous pain experience as well. We know both inter and intrapersonally, meaning that the pain experience for patients with cerebral palsy is very different from person to person, like in many patient populations, but also very significantly throughout their lifetime as well, which is very interesting. What makes it so hard for us as clinicians is that they can present with both typical and atypical manifestations of pain. Typical things being like tachycardia or what you and I might report as painful sensations. When these patients who have difficulty with verbal communication or sensory deficits may present with things like smiling or self-harm and things like that, which make it difficult to interpret pain. The first thing we have to think about when approaching the management of the pain of these patients is that these patients have significant pain burden at baseline. We know that. So about 75% of patients with cerebral palsy experience pain at least on a weekly basis, and this generally isn't intermittent pain, it's continuous significant pain. About half of patients report that they have episodes of pain lasting greater than 9 hours in any given week. So there's lots of sources of pain, whether that's musculoskeletal, neurological pain, gastrointestinal pain. And for the most part, these are chronic considerations for these patients. What I thought we would try to focus on today is maybe how we would manage post-operative or more acute pain, aside from kind of those chronic considerations as well. The one thing that's agreed upon in the literature related to the acute pain management of patients with cerebral palsy is that the approach should be to use continuous pain coverage rather than on-demand regimens, which might be a little bit different than some other patient populations, specifically because pain can be very difficult to assess, and it's important to stay on top of them. So I won't review the literature to support that because there isn't a whole lot. It's more general consensus. But I will review maybe some of the different options, so including intravenous opioids, continuous versus intermittent, and epidural opioids or epidural opioids with a local anesthetic. And so typically when we see these patients in an ICU setting postoperatively, it's after some sort of orthopedic surgery, which typically involves either manipulation of the spine or something in the lower extremities. So that's what we'll focus on today. There was one study that was published in 2013, which utilized retrospective comparison of protocol both pre and post in pediatric patients with spastic cerebral palsy undergoing selective dorsal rhizotomy, which is a surgical procedure that involves manipulation of the spine to relieve muscle spasticity. So what they did was this was a single hospital where they had had a post-operative pain protocol in place that involved systemic opioids as well as some other interventions. And then after a review of some of the recommendations for patients with cerebral palsy, specifically after spinal manipulation, they implemented an epidural protocol, and they compared pre and post what the difference in age-appropriate pain scale scores were during the 48 hours of post-operative management. And then the frequency and occurrence of severe pain episodes in those patients, classified as a pain score greater than 5 when correlated from those age-appropriate pain scale scores. They also monitored adverse effects in these patients. So comparing the protocols kind of side by side, to the left is the one that had been in place initially. So they used continuous fentanyl infusion, 1 mic per kilo per hour for 12 hours, followed by 0.5 mic per kilo per hour until noon on post-op day 2. They also had scheduled diazepam, and they added gabapentin for any patient who was over 10 years old. The second protocol was centered around the use of an epidural, ropivacaine 0.2%, and hydromorphone at a rate of 0.2 mils per kilo per hour until 6 a.m. on post-op day 3. They also utilized ketorolac and methocarbamol, scheduled ketorolac and PRN methocarbamol for breakthrough spasms. If we look kind of comparatively at how that pain coverage might have manifested in the first 2 days post-op, we see that the coverage of opioid lasted a little bit longer. There's the addition of an NSAID, which hadn't previously been present. So we'll take those things into consideration when we look at the results of this study. So patient characteristics, these patients were around 6 years old, 20 to 25 kilos, which is pretty typical for that age in this patient population. And there was a male prevalence, which is also pretty typical. Over 90% of these patients were diplegic, which, as I mentioned, is the most common presentation of spastic cerebral palsy. So let's jump right into the results here, looking at postoperative pain scores. Along the x-axis, you'll see pain scores averaged in 4-hour periods recorded by nursing, again, utilizing an age-appropriate pain score, either FLAC or FACES, which have been validated in pediatric patients. Along the y-axis, you'll see the pain scale, which goes up to 10, but it's not only goes up to 6 on this image. And then the statistically significant values have an asterisk next to them along the x-axis. So you'll see that the results are pretty overwhelmingly in favor of the epidural. You'll note that patients during the first 24 hours in the postoperative period, patients who had received the systemic analgesia rarely had pain less than 2.5. Patients in the epidural group rarely had pain more than 1.5. So they saw statistically significant results for every time period in the first 24 hours and most time periods into the 48-hour time mark. When they looked specifically at episodes of severe pain, 9.6% of patients in the epidural group and 68% of patients in the systemic group experienced some episode of severe pain that was statistically significant. Specifically in the epidural group, there were 3 patients who experienced a total of 5 episodes of severe pain, and in the systemic group, there were 28 patients who experienced a total of 74 episodes. They also saw, not surprisingly, significantly more respiratory depression in the systemic group as well. So the authors took these results into consideration and identified that a multimodal approach to pain control is probably ideal in this patient population, and that the epidural may be a preferred route of administration both for efficacy and safety in these patients in the postoperative setting, specifically following a spinal manipulation. Of course, there are several limitations to consider in specifically using a study design like this retrospectively comparing two protocols, particularly when we look at the comparative coverage, specifically the period of time that patients received opioids, as well as the modes of mechanism of action that were used as well. So it's not surprising that we saw statistically significant differences. The source of that difference is what's difficult to pinpoint. An overarching concern with this study, which has been used to support the use of epidural analgesia in patients, as well as a lot of studies that assess acute pain management in cerebral palsy patients, is that pain assessment tools just plain aren't that reliable and a good tool to base a study around. So the fact is that there are three validated pain assessment tools for patients with cerebral palsy. The one on the left, pediatric pain profile, and the one on the right, non-communication children's pain checklist, are associated with a lot more intensive evaluation of patients, which many nurses just aren't trained to do, and can be very time intensive. The one that is validated that many are more familiar with is the one in the middle, FLAC, which stands for faces, legs, activity, cry, and consolability, which is a scale we typically use in neonatal patients to gauge their pain, but has been approved in a post-operative setting for patients with severe neurological impairments. So realistically, this may be the scale of choice when assessing cerebral palsy patients in a critical ICU setting, despite their age. So to review and kind of take that point home, which of the following may be a sign of pain in a nonverbal patient with cerebral palsy? Flushing and or pallor, tachycardia, sudden stiffness, or self-harm? All right, so I agree with the majority. All of the above may be signs of pain in a patient with cerebral palsy. The take-home point here is that it can be very challenging to assess pain in these patients, and maybe the best thing that we can do is to consult with caregivers about how these patients typically present with pain. And finally, to move into the topic of procedural sedation in this patient population. Historically, it's been preferred to use agents with anti-epileptic properties in these patients because there's such a high rate of comorbid epilepsy. So propofol and benzodiazepines are the drugs that seem to be of choice in past literature dating back, you know, more recently, like 90s and early 2000s. And beyond that, there's been no real studies of newer sedative agents for procedural sedation, but we can generally say that none are truly contraindicated in this patient population. It's important to consider comorbidities, but in general, the optimal approach and optimal doses just remain very controversial in this patient population. There are some general concepts when it comes to sedation that many people apply to procedural sedation as well. We know that disability, and specifically cerebral palsy, is associated with increased risks with sedation, like increased risk for respiratory depression and delayed awakening. A 2013 review of 1,500 patients with disabilities revealed that cerebral palsy itself was independently associated with respiratory depression, but not necessarily independently associated with delayed awakening, unless they had comorbid intellectual disability. Other general concepts that have come from the literature and kind of guided the way we approach these patients is that there was a study in 2005 which revealed that patients who were receiving propofol for induction of anesthesia required significantly less propofol when compared to their healthy counterparts, noting that the typical dosage range for these patients anyway is 2.5 to 3.5 mg/kg. And so these patients with cerebral palsy didn't even necessarily fall out of that dosing range. And then in 1997, there was this large cohort that led to the conclusion that patients with cerebral palsy require less inhaled anesthesia during surgery, when they showed that patients with cerebral palsy had 20% lower minimal alveolar concentrations, meaning they required less inhaled anesthetics. And they possibly linked this to an increased risk of delayed emergence. So in general, these concepts that Patients with cerebral palsy are more sensitive to sedation, have applied across the board into the use of procedural sedation, despite there not being a whole lot of evidence to support that that's the best way to support them. In 2011, there was a single study that tried to identify the optimal therapeutic dosing range for propofol for procedural sedation for MRI. They used a modified sequential up-down method to try to identify an ED50 and an ED95 for the best starting dose of procedural sedation propofol in patients with cerebral palsy aged 6 months to 5 years who were scheduled to undergo MRI. They started at 2 mg per kg, which is a typical procedural dosing for propofol. And then in sequential order, if they had a patient who was unsuccessful at that dose, they increased the next dose by 0.5 mg per kg. And if they had someone that was successful at that dose, they tried to decrease it and see if they could get the same response. The patients in this study were around 2 to 3 years old, had a typical weight, were primarily male, and had an MRI scanning time of about 26 minutes. Of note in this study specifically, they had 75% of patients had comorbid behavior disturbances, and only 25% of the patients were on anti-epileptic medications, which is not really reflective of the general population. So when they utilized this up-down method, they had successful completion of all MRI scans using 0.5 mg per kg boluses if they started to emerge. But what they judged the success on was the initial dose of propofol and whether or not they received appropriate sedation within 1 minute. So in total, 10 patients received that standard 2 mg per kg, 5 bumped down to 1.5. None of those were successful when given a lower dose, and 5 received 2.5 mg per kg with 80% success. And so of note, 4 patients in that 2.5 mg per kg group did experience desaturations, and 1 patient in the 2 mg per kg group experienced desaturation. So based on these results, they concluded that a proposed therapeutic index would be about 2.07 mg per kg to 2.69 mg per kg, noting that the up-down method and the logistic regression that they used wasn't necessarily an ideal method for proposing a therapeutic index. Again, this falls kind of within our typical starting procedural sedation range, but raised kind of some questions based on the underlying assumptions we had about patients with cerebral palsy, as it was suspected that these patients would probably be responsive to more of a 1.5 mg per kg dose based on what's been previously assumed. So in general, it just leaves some lingering questions about whether or not cerebral palsy alone really warrants use of lower doses up front for procedural sedation. And it leaves a lot of other questions, like if not cerebral palsy in general, what specific subgroups of patients should be considered for lower doses of procedural sedation? Is the desaturation in 25% of patients overall significant? Do we need to reassess the way we're considering someone having an appropriate sedation response in this patient population? And what is the appropriate starting dose for propofol and procedural sedation? And quite honestly, the same questions can be asked about any agent we might typically use for procedural sedation in the ICU. And I'm disappointed to share with you, there's not a lot of literature to support the right dose. So the bottom line for approaching pain and sedation in these patients is that the first thing that we should do is maybe assess and treat for anxiety in this setting, because those symptoms can be hard to differentiate from pain in these patients. Use a multimodal approach to pain, considering the chronic pain burden that these patients have over time. And don't forget about all those baseline pain factors and continue their home medications to cover for those as well. It's generally accepted that continuous pain control should be used in these patients over on-demand pain control because pain is so difficult to assess. And keep that in mind as you're managing these patients, and we may not be able to rely on a typical pain score reported in a patient chart. Maybe more useful is that we can rely on caregiver assessments of what their pain looks like, maybe what their anxiety looks like to differentiate those, and the best way they respond to pain management. And then finally, when we're using procedural sedation or sedative medications in an ICU setting, there's not a whole lot of literature to support one way or another the best way to dose these patients. There's probably a lot more research that needs to be done. In general, I would propose starting on the low end of a normal dosing range and titrating very slowly, knowing that these patients may be a little bit more sensitive or may even require more, depending what you read. And so for our last assessment question, we have a mini case. So a 24-year-old male weighing 30 kilos with cerebral palsy. Status post and orthopedic surgery is being admitted to your ICU. Which of the following standard post-operative orders would be your priority for reassessment prior to his arrival to the unit? A morphine PCA with a 2 milligram load followed by 1 milligram every 10 minutes with a Q4-hour lockout. Ketorolac 15 milligrams Q6 hours for 4 doses, cefazolin 1 gram Q8 hours for 2 doses, or Senna 17.2 milligrams PO at bedtime. There's not necessarily a correct answer here, so follow your heart. All right, so we have 8 responses, and we have a 50-50 split. How exciting! So personally, my priority here would be to assess the use of a morphine PCA, specifically you know, looking at those doses based on this patient's weight, I would probably use a pediatric protocol in terms of a PCA, which would be a different order set compared to the adult order set. And if we used a level 1 morphine PCA dose, his load would come out to be a little bit lower than 2 milligrams. Particularly using opioids, I would be a little bit more hesitant to use adult orders. The truth is you would probably assess all of these medications for their doses, but ketorolac does come out to have around 15 milligrams would be an appropriate dose for this patient. And we saw that in that epidural protocol, adding ketorolac, whether or not that led to more effective pain control, utilizing a multimodal approach is probably appropriate in these patients postoperatively. The cefazolin dose comes out to be about a gram, so that would be appropriate. And Senna, knowing these patients have a lot of comorbid gastrointestinal comorbidities, constipation being very common in these patients, particularly when adding an opioid, would most likely be appropriate, and that is an appropriate dose. So kind of a trick question if you didn't know pediatric dosing off the top of your head, but my priority would be to assess the morphine. So in summary, there's kind of a lack of published experience in managing patients with cerebral palsy in ICU settings. In general, when we approach their medications, we should assess for appropriate weight-based dosing in patients who are of smaller size, consider drug interactions and medication withdrawal. And finally, cerebral palsy, much to my disappointment, was I was hoping to share a good guideline for approaching pain and sedation. This disease state doesn't necessarily permit a one-size-fits-all approach to their pain and sedation management.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.